Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, Herren und Gentlemen und Frauen, heute Abend, ce soir, nous présentons avec plaisir tonight. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Wir haben heute kanadischer Film von einer Junge, geboren in Deutschland. Le Médecin de la Lumière Prise, L'Avance des Catastrophes, the new film by Toronto filmmaker Michael Holborn. C'est un film voyageant dans la grande tradition française. Il nous dit à l'évêquant de métro parisien et du textile. Un film, das ist ein Taschentuch für die delikatesse Hand von dieser jungen Nase. We will turn in short order to the filmmaker himself, who has prepared a brief statement outlining his financial hopes for the upcoming screening. Denn seine Kamera, ist sehr krank. Kann nur an Fotos machen aus weißer Papier. Das ist immer selber Sachen.
Let us imagine a society without language. Here is a man copulating with a woman and using in the act a bit of wheat paste. On this level, a no perversion. Only by adding nouns does the crime gradually discover itself. The man is called the father of the woman he's holding, who is described as being married. Their love is called sodomy, and the bit of bread's become, under the noun host, a religious symbol whose crossing is sacrilege. De Sade excels in collecting this pile, this heap of language. For him, crime begins with a sentence. Refined by years of culture, it collects crime with an exacting measure. He writes, to unite incest, adultery, sodomy, and sacrilege, he buggers his married daughter with a host.
I guess I should begin with an apology about there being so few images so far. And now that the credits have finished, we usually get into the film and start to see what's happening. But the truth of the matter is that I just don't have enough money for the images. Even when I told them at the lab how disappointed people would be to have to watch a film without images, they wouldn't give me any credit. They said it would look okay when it got transferred to video. I feel especially bad about the beginning because it was going to be something really special. It was going to start off in the Paris underground at dusk. Perhaps you could imagine it now, where a tall man, not too handsome, passes through the turnstiles when a young couple approaches, and suddenly, without any warning at all, the girl literally throws her baby into his arm, saying, "Take my baby," in French, or maybe she has a beret on, so you know it's Paris. And he holds the baby there, completely stopped, while the young man robs him, and the mother snatches back her child, and they run down the track. It's a true story, Michelle told me when she got back from Paris, the city. I wanted to get Jean-Pierre Léaud to play the lead, but, you know, because he's so fat now, no one recognizes him, so he has to start all over again, from scratch, and I thought that this is where I was, too, at the beginning, and that we might be able to find our way together. But there was no hiding the fact I didn't have the money. Even Jean-Pierre needs to eat. The cinema is all money, but the money figures twice. First, you spend all your time running to get the money to make the film, but then in the film, the money comes back again, in the image. I think it's true what they say, that the order and content of the image follows the order and content of the money. The cost of identity is high when the making of images is determined by the distribution. So then I started to think of ways I might get around this problem.
have to do?
Of having no money. I thought of leaving instructions for the projectionist to flip the lamp on and off at the crucial moments. But that seemed too complicated, really, and I don't go in for all those Hollywood-type special effects anyway. Or maybe I thought they could run just the picture of another film while I was talking. But there'd only be copyright problems afterwards, and then maybe people had seen this other film before and really liked it. And now maybe the colors faded or the picture's scratched. Or maybe it would be so much better than the rest, you'd want to hear the original sound too, and I'd be right back where I started from. I should probably tell you before we get any further that I wasn't quite straight with you when I said I didn't have any money. The fact is I borrowed just a little from a friend, just enough for one image. But I just didn't want to give it away right at the beginning. Not before telling you the story first, anyway. I thought I'd save it up for later so you'd have something to look forward to. So I guess this is all sort of a forward or an hors d'oeuvre before we can get to the place where I'm able to show something and you're able to see it. This is my favorite time for a movie anyway, before the curtain rises, or when the projectionist is a little hungover, so he runs off all of the head leader on the screen, so you can see the white at the beginning and the countdown. It's at that moment that the film is completely pure for me, because it's exactly what I want to see. It's at that moment that the film most perfectly becomes you, like in that saying, "Oh, that dress becomes you," or "That's a becoming passport photo," that is, that you're ready to travel from one place to the next with a passing that begins as an image and leaves off with imagination. After that moment, when the film starts, you can already feel the change taking place as that pure sort of expectation gets taken away by this thing, this movie, until at the end, there's really nothing left of you at all.
Before looking at the gold arrow, let's think about Pack Holiday.
When Svet and I would go to see the pictures, we would shake a little bit when the screen lit up. But most of the time, we were just disappointed.
You probably won't go far.
The pictures were dated. They flickered.
And you won't
stay away
very long.
Marilyn Monroe had aged terribly. It made us sad. This wasn't the film we dreamed of. This wasn't the total film each of us carried within himself.
The
film that we wanted to make, or more secretly, no doubt, that we wanted to live. As a filmmaker, I start with everything in the world, with the back of a face, a stairwell, a map, the light of the water. My camera never stops at its subject. It never says, "No, not this one. This is too much for me," or "I'd like to think about this first," or "I'm too tired now." So as a filmmaker or a viewer of the film, you always begin at the same place with everything, with every image. And from there, you have to make a selection, a choice. The back of his leg with the ocean liner. The cracks on the eastrow with a clown reciting Virgil. For me, film isn't so much an act of tracing or making likeness, but a composition thing. An arrangement of parts. A relationship. Two weeks ago at work, we were let off for the night to go have a look at another photo lab. It was a kind of field trip, and most of us saw it as a chance to take some time off work, grab a couple of beers downtown, make an appearance at this place, and still get paid. But once we walked in, it was completely different. We watched a man sitting by his computer take a picture of an ocean liner and feed it into the machine so it showed up on a TV screen. It was a very old liner, one of the first that rolled out of dry dock after the First War, and we watched it quietly sailing without a soul on deck under clear skies and calm waters. I think it was going to be used as a logo for a whiskey ad. After that, the picture started to change. Entering numbers into the machine, the man changed the color of the sky from a mid-afternoon cyan to a twilight purple, and then he added dark storm clouds along the horizon, with your choice of cirrostratus, altostratus, stratocumulus, nimbostratus, or cumulus. And then he added a sun at the left border. Then he started to work in the water, asking us whether we preferred large waves or small, and then made them conform perfectly to the prow of the ship. He added people on deck after that, children from the Sudan, fathers in the Napoleonic Wars, and women in the Restoration, carefully arranging each figure along the way in a suitable gesture of distress. When he was finished, he entered a final command that would make a negative of the scene. While we were being taken upstairs to eat, the negative would be processed and printed, so we could all leave with this reminder in our hands that there was less a need to make objects in a world already filled with objects, that everything was already there at the beginning. So I had to find a place far enough away to see a great deal, so that in my weaving of a text that was also a textile, I'd be able to find the yarns that carried me to my own place without making of the present an image of a history that could only be understood by repeating itself, by a retelling, renaming, representation, by making of the present an image of the past that could be neither changed or understood, but simply waited with us to be carried up into some more distant place until future generations would succeed us.
As in the silver arrow, if for some reason you cannot learn the story, our tailor may allow you to do a different test. The stage two swimmer badge may seem hard, but it's not
really. If this film's taken me a long time to make, or a long time to come to, it's not because it's so different from the kinds of images that have moved before mine, but because the ordering of the images, the way one thing comes before another, needs to come out of some new idea of what relationship is for me. I have to start over here, on this side, with Mary, and find out how it's possible for us to be together. And then I'll know something of how one image moves into another, and not before. Not to take up a position on one side or the other, but to come together in a dialogue, in a kind of questioning. The film can only double in its remaking, renaming, retelling, representation. I don't know. I've always held on to this idea of filmmaking being able to move me into places where I don't belong, into a place that's so close to yourself you could only see it again as an image. Like in the Medusa story, where he has to find her without being able to see her. So he holds up his shield to catch her reflection, because if he looked at her with his own eyes, he'd be turned to stone. It's the same story in the sealed texts of the apocalypse the writers wrote that couldn't be watched over. The books that told of a final ending with such force that their simple act of reading might provoke the events they describe and would nearly certainly bring about the madness of their reader. Which is why the books were always sealed after they were written. And that's the literal meaning of apocalypse, the breaking of this seal, but with an image, with something between your mouth and the words, you might be able to pass into the book and still find your way from the page when the time comes.
Or a famous beauty spot like the Lake District. Then you must find out how you would get there using public transport. Get a grown-up to help you find the time to
when
train, and how much
you
the fares will be.
Then you meet up with another person. You never think, well, this is all there is. You never think of people ending up what they do. Some end with their father, or in their mouth, or in their sex. And then it's time to leave.
No, I had no idea you...
You know it just by the look in their eyes, by the way they say hello. It's already too much. It's already over. And you have to go away now, because there isn't any more. There's nothing left.
I always think about the people who build buildings, and then they're not around anymore. Or a movie with a crowd scene, and everybody's dead now. It's frightening.
I'm really very impressed with you.
And tiny twigs are needed to start the fire.
But
have your bigger wood
ready. I think, if not for marriage bells or funerals, a writer would hardly know where to stop. And I thought about that some, because it seems like I'm always caught between the two. Between beginning and ending. Between never wanting it to start and never wanting it to end. Sometimes when you read a book, the writing makes a place for you, and you go to live there for a time, and you don't feel yourself in the reading so much as looking around you in this new place. But even then, even if you like to read the dust jacket after the book's finished, you still have to close the book sometimes, and then it's over. And I think of ending like that, as something you can hold in your hands, as something that closes. Before I was taken to the hospital, I always thought I was more half there than all there. I always suspected that I was watching television instead of living life. People sometimes say that the way things happen in the movies is unreal. But really, it's the way things happen to you in life that's unreal.
Right.
The movies make emotions look so strong, whereas when things really do happen to you, it's like watching television. You don't feel anything. The best atmosphere I can think of is a film, because it's three-dimensionally physically and two-dimensional emotionally.
Paper and carton spoil the view.
I lived in all the books I read before I was nine, and then I started to watch TV. And things didn't end so much after that. Even when I had to go to bed, I knew it wasn't over, because I could hear my parents laughing in the front room. And I thought that if I could listen hard enough, I could faintly hear the sound of their parents laughing after they went to bed, and their parents after they went to bed.
A Cub Scout must know which side.
And I asked my parents about that
how to
when I was four or five.
If there is no pavement,
I asked about the place between us, or how I'd manage to move from one place to another. And he told me then, he taught me to say after him that I was descended from my mother and my father. And when I turned to ask my mother, she replied in the same way that I was descended from them. And as I sat to think about this, it occurred to me to ask where they had managed from. And they said that they were descended from their parents. And their parents, I asked, where were their parents from? And they told me that their parents, too, were descended from their parents, and their parents from their parents, and so on. So as I thought about the shape of our race, it seemed to describe nothing so much as a large descent, moving from one generation to the next.
Find out something about another country and describe it to them.
Handwork
is fun.
I still like the city.
You must make one of the following.
In the big cities, they've set it up so you can go to a park and be in a miniature countryside.
Let's listen to a
but in the countryside, they don't have any patches of
remember,
big city.
You choose one.
So I get very homesick. Another reason I like the city better than the country is that in the city, everything is geared to working, and in the country, everything is geared to relaxing. I like working better than relaxing. In the city, even the trees in the parks work hard, because the number of people they have to make oxygen and chlorophyll for is staggering. Excuse me. If you live in Canada, you might have a million trees making oxygen for you alone, so each of those trees isn't working that hard. But a tree in a tree pot in Times Square has to make oxygen for a million people.
or enlarge.
In New York,
you already
you
have.
Really have to hustle.
It should
and
now
the trees
be mounted
know this
properly
too.
And well. Entertaining is for cover.
I like the idea
choose
that
to do
people in Toronto have to wait in line for movies. You go by so many theaters where they have those long lineups. But nobody looks bad about it. It costs so much money just to live now. And if you're on a date, you can spend your whole date time in line. And that way it saves you money because you don't have to think of other things to do while you're waiting. And you get to know your person and you suffer a little together. And then you're entertained for 2 hours. So you've gotten very close. You've shared a complete experience. And the idea of waiting for something makes it more exciting anyway. Never getting in is the most exciting, but after that, waiting to get in is the most exciting. Has everyone had a chance to introduce themselves to one another? Or is this one of those movie houses where you're supposed to pretend you can't see anyone but the people you came with? Maybe for the people who came late, maybe we could just have the lights turned on for a minute. Just to have a look around. Just to see who's here. Could the projectionist please turn the lights on for a second? Could the projectionist please turn the lights? When Warhol said that everyone in the future would be famous for 60 seconds, I wonder if it wasn't because eventually we all say the same thing. That all of our words come back to the same point. I remember I started seeing Lisa when I was maybe 15, and she was really the first one who thought, well, he wears check flannel trousers with paisley shirts and fly top runners. Well, I have two-tone jumpers and Kitakura soap and full-bodied hair that falls with the radiant luster of Brex pH balanced conditioner. But these differences weren't everything. That these were things that could be looked over as one looks over an atlas or a book of pictures. And it was Lisa who taught me the words that moved between these two places, from one sort of difference to another. She said, I love you. And I said it after that, in just the same way. And then with all of the girls after Lisa, it was just the same. I love you. Until I'd lost the feeling of the word altogether. So, when I met up with Mary after that, there was no way for her to tell you meant nothing you said, that you spoke only from habit and to be comfortable. After I'd made this place between the meaning of a word and its speaking, my lying was more welcome than when I told the truth. And I wondered about that, about the way a word loses its place inside a mouth, that you could just forget the way a word turns one thing into another. Like this, I love you. And that if you could gather up all of the times you used a word and lay them in a line one after another, they take themselves into a vanishing point. That every word moves towards a place